This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I just returned from Poland, and it was, and spent a lot of time with former members of Solidarity who had struggled for many years against the communist regime, triumphed in 1989, built an open society, and now it's been completely destroyed. And it crystallized what's happening in the United States and globally. Because in Poland, in that transformation from state-managed capitalism to neoliberalism, you had the shock therapy, Jeffrey Sachs and others, that were imposed on these countries that devastated the working class. And once the working class was devastated in the same way it's been through deindustrialization in the United States, those forces made war against culture, public education, public broadcasting, support for the arts, all of those mechanisms within the society that give us the capacity to understand, critique, and transform ourselves were washed away. Replaced, of course, with spectacle. And finally, the political system itself was eviscerated so that in October of last year, you had the election of a proto-fascist government, which has eradicated the systems of checks and balances, that has turned the public airwaves into an overt system of propaganda buttressed by a racist nationalism. Poland, as many of you know, has a very checkered history in terms of its relationship with the Jews. 3 million Jews, Polish Jews, were killed in the Holocaust. But what the Poles have traditionally been unable to acknowledge, in the same way that I think white supremacy has been unable to acknowledge within our own country, the mutations of slavery that still exist, the forms of neo-slavery, our entire system of mass incarceration is built on the practice of neo-slavery, i.e. you work 40 hours a week and you are not compensated, or you are compensated a dollar a day. In states like Alabama, you're not compensated at all. And these systems would not function without that neo-slavery. And Poland, in the 1930s, and the Polish Republic is now called the Third Republic, as if communism never took place. Poland in the 1930s was a kind of crypto-fascist state like Hungary and Croatia and other states. And as the historian Jan Gross has pointed out, during the German occupation, the Poles killed far more Jews than they did Germans. And this has been erased from history. And that brief opening, that cultural and intellectual opening that Solidarity made possible under Lech Walesa, who is now demonized by the state media as a Soviet agent, that opening that exposed the truth about Polish anti-Semitism is being completely challenged. Exhumations of some of the massacre sites have stopped. The government has denounced, has created a huge fund to prosecute people who would even dare suggest that this took place. And that rise of this intolerant nationalism, which we see now within our own country, is a direct consequence of the assault of neoliberalism, which worked in Poland the same way it works in the United States. The destruction of the stability and possibilities for the working class. 2 million Poles, or most young, have gone abroad looking for jobs. the destruction of culture, and finally, the evisceration of the political system itself. So that when the immigrants start pouring into Europe, fleeing the chaos that we engendered in the Middle East, a country like Poland is able to use the same language about Muslim immigrants, word for word, that it used about Jews. They bring diseases. I'm quoting the highest levels of government. They rape women. And they practice a barbaric religion. And Poland has not accepted, despite EU quotas, one immigrant. And all of this is now being writ large within the United States because the same forces that destroyed Polish democracy destroyed American democracy. And in some ways, as much as I cover this, I needed to step into the milieu of Poland to see with more clarity what's happening around us, because when you're that close, sometimes you lose perspective. And much of the collapse of Poland and Hungary, which is already a police state, was caused by a bankrupt liberalism, a liberalism that tolerated the intolerant. And that, as Karl Popper reminds us in The Open Society and Its Enemies, ultimately leads to the disappearance of tolerance and the tolerant themselves. The poisoning of civil discourse on the airwaves, in particular, by outlets such as Fox News, has an insidious effect within the society because it legitimizes hate speech and racism, homophobia, and anti-intellectualism, all of which we are now see rising within the campaign within the Republican Party. It is that failure on the part of a liberal elite to stand for the purported values that they espouse. In fact, betray those values. And Hillary Clinton embodies this betrayal, which has given rise to neo or proto-fascist movements abroad and within the United States. And of course, this was done in the name of political expediency, in the name of the practical, in the name of realism. So that under the Clinton administration, you have the first of the devastating trade agreements, NAFTA, the greatest betrayal of the American working class since the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act, which makes it very difficult to organize. It's under Clinton that you get our monstrous system of mass incarceration through the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, laws, three strikes, you're outlaws, that put nonviolent offenders in this country, half of whom comprise the 2.2 million prisoners in America, half of whom never committed a violent crime. For life. So the prison population explodes under Clinton from 700,000 to 2 million. It's under Clinton you destroy welfare, and 70% of the original recipients under the old welfare system were children. It's under Clinton that you deregulate the FCC so that a half dozen corporations, Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, control what 90% of Americans listen to and watch. And it's under Clinton that you revoke the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act that built firewalls between investment and commercial banks and precipitated the national and finally the global meltdown. And the Democratic Party was well paid for this. By the 90s, it had fundraising parity with the Republicans. And when Barack Obama ran for president, like Hillary Clinton, he received more Wall Street money than his Republican opponent. And so, as vile, as frightening, as buffoonish, and we should not be naive about what it is to be a buffoon. I covered the war in Yugoslavia. And the conflict in Yugoslavia, which gave rise to war criminals and ethnic nationalists, was not caused by ancient ethnic hatreds. This is the lie told so often as well about the Middle East. It was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia. The failure on the part of a government to respond to the increasing grievances, anxieties, dislocations, misery, and fear that beset working men and women. And out of that, you vomited up figures like Radovan Karadzic or Slobodan Milosevic or Franjo Tuđman, who had the same buffoonish quality that you find in Donald Trump. But once in power, of course, and the Nazis before 1933, figures like Goring or Himmler or Goebbels were seen by the German elites in the same way, parodied and made fun of in the cabarets in Berlin, much the way Jon Stewart or Colbert or others makes fun of these people. So what we are confronting at this moment is not a personality. The personalities of Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton don't matter. That's the political game they want you to play, which is one that is driven solely by fear. Fear stoked by Trump about the other, about the immigrant, about the African American, or fear stoked by the Democratic Party about the homophobes, the Islamophobes, and the racists. But structurally, what takes place under neoliberalism, or what Sheldon Wolin calls inverted totalitarianism, Wolin, who we lost a year ago at the age of 92, without question, our greatest contemporary political philosopher, wrote Politics and Vision, taught at Princeton and Berkeley, and his last book, Democracy Incorporated. What he describes as a form of corporate totalitarianism that is as totalitarian as fascism or communism, but reconfigured. So that in inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport, as in the late Roman Republic, to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet internally have seized all of the levers of power to render the citizen impotent. There is no way within the system of inverted totalitarianism to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. And that will be as true under a Trump presidency as under a Clinton presidency. And the question is, how do we halt this slide? We must not forget that Barack Obama's assault on civil liberties has been far worse than what was carried out under the Bush administration. The reinterpretation of the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act as giving the government the right, or the executive branch the right, to execute American citizens. And of course, I'm speaking about Anwar al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son in Yemen. The insertion of Section 1021 in the National Defense Authorization Act, signed into law by Obama on New Year's Eve, 2011, when he thought no one was looking, which overturns the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibits the military from being used as a domestic police force. Which allows the military to seize any citizen who is deemed by the state to either be a terrorist or support, in the language of this section, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or quote-unquote associated forces, strip them of due process, and hold them in indefinite detention until, in the language of that section, the end of hostilities, which in an age of permanent war is a lifetime. And as some of you may know, I sued the president in federal court over Section 1021. And to our surprise, the surprise of the attorneys, Bruce Afron and Carl Mayer and myself, Chomsky joined me in the suit. We won. And this created a crisis within the security and surveillance apparatus, the most pervasive security and surveillance apparatus in human history. And I covered the Stasi state in East Germany. And so, instead of the federal attorneys descending on Judge Catherine B. Forrest's chamber the day of the ruling, in which she issued a temporary injunction banning that provision as unconstitutional, the lawyers from the NSA appeared and said, in the name of national security, this law must be put back into effect. And to her credit, she refused. That was a Friday. By 9 a.m. Monday morning, they were in the appellate court, the Second Circuit, which would review the case, because, of course, Obama appealed. They made the same argument, and the law was put back into effect. And that moment was important because it's a window into the collapse of our judiciary. It's an explication of how our judiciary has, like every other institution that is meant to promote democracy, become a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate state. Because the appellate court was faced with a crisis. It is clearly unconstitutional to use the U.S. military as a police force to seize American citizens in acts of extraordinary rendition off the streets of American cities and hold them in indefinite detention in black sites, including in our offshore penal colonies. And so they heard the hearing. We had the hearing, in which the government lawyers made jokes. The case was called Hedges versus Obama, about myself being taken away in a black van with tinted windows. And for months, they refused to rule. I was a plaintiff in a Supreme Court case called Clapper versus Amnesty International, where before the Snowden revelations, we challenged wholesale surveillance. And in the Supreme Court trial, the government attorneys said that I and the other plaintiffs had no right to bring the case because our charge that the government was engaging in wholesale surveillance of the citizenry was quote-unquote speculation. And if we were being watched by the government, we would be informed. And the case was thrown out And then the appellate court said, Hedges does not have standing in Clapper versus Amnesty International. Therefore, he does not have standing or a right to bring the case in Hedges versus Obama, and it is law. And this is an important window into how the judiciary has overturned constitutional rights by judicial fiat, including the failure to protect our right to privacy, including the monstrous decision by the Supreme Court that unlimited campaign cash under Citizens United fulfills the right to petition the government and is a form of free speech. From top to bottom, the judiciary, which I think was the last institution by which those of us who care about a liberal democracy placed our faith, has collapsed. As anyone who comes out of a marginal community in this city knows, there is no such thing as a free trial if you are poor. You are stacked with charges and forced to plea out. And if you go to trial, it is certain not only that all of those charges will be arrayed against you, but your sentence will be double or triple what it would be if you had accepted a plea deal, which is why 40% of the people who are exonerated of crimes, this is the state saying they did not commit those crimes, pled guilty. The society under neoliberalism has devolved into a frightening, terrifying, anti-democratic, and deeply cruel system where human beings and the ecosystem are sacrificed on the altar of corporate profit. Within our prison system, 350,000 to 400,000 people have severe mental illness. 60% of our prison population shows signs of mental illness, not surprising when you're placed in solitary confinement, which is meant to induce mental illness and does. And that is because with the deinstitutionalization, we threw our mentally ill on the streets of our cities. We failed to provide them, as they were children within our schools, with adequate psychiatric help, which of course meant they deteriorated, were unable to function, and find themselves locked in cages, usually 23 or 24 hours a day, because when you are mentally ill, it is extremely difficult to follow the rigid discipline and rules imposed upon prisoners. The hunger that has beset poor families, the indiscriminate police violence, how has neoliberalism responded to the deterioration it created? It has turned pockets of this country into rapacious, brutal, violent police states, including North Philadelphia, where your door can be kicked down at 2 a.m. and men in black uniforms and Kevlar vests and long-barreled weapons terrorize your family for a non-violent drug offense. Where you can be stopped at random, where you can sit in a county jail for 2 years without charges, and since you have no hope of a fair trial, 94% of people in our prisons had to plea out. You have formed what Hannah Arendt in The Origins of Totalitarianism warned us about. And that is the creation within a society of what she calls omnipotent police states. Places where police are beyond the law. Where they can terrorize and kill with impunity. And Arendt writes from her own experience, because of course she was expelled from Germany, stripped of her citizenship, found herself stateless in France. She writes that once you create the physical and legal mechanism to strip a segment of a population of their rights, rights become privileges. They are no longer rights. And the moment the state feels a threat or there is instability, with a flick of a switch, you have a legal and a physical mechanism to strip everyone else of their rights. The state knows where we're going. It knows what climate change will do, including to this city. It knows that the casino capitalism and games of speculation globally are not sustainable. Even the biggest banks in Germany are teetering on collapse. And when that comes, they're ready. They're ready with the legal and physical mechanisms to do to us what they have been doing now for decades to poor people of color, who the liberal elites turn their backs on. Busying themselves with a boutique kind of activism, multiculturalism, diversity, all of which I'm for, but not at the expense of justice. So how do we respond to the forces arrayed against us? It is not allowing, which will be the primary campaign message of the Democratic Party, it is not allowing them to make us afraid. It is about understanding systems of power and not being caught up in personalities. Because what we have now within this electoral system are two forms of a con game. Yes, Trump is cruder. But Hillary Clinton's long record in public life illustrate that while she may not use the language, overt language of racism, she is willing to support policies that cement into place an increasing form of institutionalized racism, a war against poor men and women. Part of the terror of the system of mass incarceration is that it is now impossible within our legislative system to challenge it because corporate lobbyists who profit from this system write the laws and fund the campaigns, including the Clinton campaign. And prisoners in California and Alabama and Ohio in particular have formed a movement where they will begin national prison work stoppages starting on September 9th, the anniversary of the Attica uprising, because they said the only way we are going to stop slavery is by stop being slaves. And they understand the dynamics of the political system that is lost on many of us. That if we are to reverse this rapid advance towards a form of Christian fascism, towards cementing into place a more brutal form of inverted totalitarianism, it will never come by succumbing to the system itself, but by defying it. In everything that we do now, we must find within ourselves the capacity to say no, to refuse to cooperate. To step outside of that narrow circle, those tiny parameters that they have set for us, which means sustained acts of mass civil disobedience, the building of movements and third parties that challenge those forces that will not only ultimately and in very short time destroy what is left of our anemic democracy, but the planet itself. I'm not naive enough to stand here and tell you we will win. I covered the civil war in El Salvador and watched, with the help of the Reagan administration, the crushing of the peasant movements that rose up. But we cannot use the word hope if we do not find it within ourselves to resist. And hope has within it that capacity to impart a moral force that is often unseen at that moment of rebellion or resistance. I covered the revolutions in Eastern Europe. I was in Leipzig, in East Germany, shortly after the dictator Erich Honecker, in order to crush the demonstrations, had sent down an elite paratroop division to fire on the crowds, and when they arrived in Leipzig, they refused. And Honecker, who had been in power for 19 years, was out of power within a week. I was in Czechoslovakia during the Velvet Revolution. I spent every evening in the Magic Lantern Theater with Václav Havel and Klaus and Dinsbier. And all through the streets of the city were posters of a young Charles University student named Jan Palach, who in 1968, when Dubček was overthrown by Soviet tanks and a pro-Soviet regime was installed to take his place, went to Wenceslas Square and lit himself on fire. 4 days later, he died of his burns. His funeral, attended by university students, a non-event on state television and in the state media, was broken up by police. When his grave became a shrine, his body was exhumed, he was cremated, his ashes were given to his mother, and she was told she could not rebury them. His poster that winter covered the walls of Prague. And 1 week after the communist government fell, 10,000 Czechs marched to Red Army Square, and they renamed it Jan Palach Square. That is the power of resistance, which at the time they will tell you is futile. I was in Wenceslas Square when the great Czech singer Marta Kubasheva walked out on the balcony in front of 500,000 people. In 1989, as the Soviets were advancing on Prague, she took to the airwaves to sing an anthem of defiance known as the Prayer for Marta. When the Soviet, pro-Soviet regime took over, all of her recording stock was destroyed, she was banned from the airwaves, and she had spent the intervening years working on an assembly line in a toy factory. I was in that crowd when she walked out on that balcony and she began to sing the prayer for Marta, and every Czech in the crowd knew every word. That is the power of resistance, the ability to overcome fear, to stand for a moral truth, to fight for justice even against insurmountable odds. Because in the end, I do not fight fascists. because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you.